Welcome to Torah Mecha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Zivi Zuckerman, and today we will be studying Malachim Bet, Perek Yud Zayin, Chapter 17. The story of the 10 lost tribes has become one of the most popular and intriguing stories throughout history. Geographers, adventurers, and even politicians have hypothesized and journeyed to try and discover the location of these mysterious tribes. To us, as modern-day Jews, they are such a distant memory that we don't necessarily comprehend the tragedy that their exile represents. The exile of the 10 northern tribes marked the loss of approximately 80% of the Jewish population at the time. It boggles the mind to think about the magnitude of this loss. Given Hashem's abundant mercy and patience with the sins of the Jewish people, and the opportunities he provides for tshuva, we can recognize that if these tribes were exiled, they must have reached a point of no return. There is a debate in the Gemara about whether the lost tribes will return in the time of Mashiach, and the conclusion seems to be that they will in fact return at that time. Let us try to understand the events leading up to the exile of the 10 tribes and try to gain a deeper understanding of the pull toward idolatry that led to their downfall. We can divide this parak into three parts. The beginning of the parak details the events leading to the exile of the 10 tribes. The parak then gives a history of the Aseret HaShvatim, the 10 tribes of Malchut Yisrael, and the causes of their decline, focusing on the sin of Avodah Zarah. And lastly, the parak discusses how the Assyrians resettled Eretz Yisrael by bringing the Kutim to live there, thereby creating a problematic social and religious reality in the land of Israel that would have reverberations for centuries. The parak begins with Hoshea ben Ela, who assassinated the previous king, Pekach ben Remaliah. Hoshea is slightly better than his predecessors, as Pasuk Bet, verse 2, states, Vayaz hara be'inei Hashem, rak lo kamalchei Yisrael asher hayu lefanav. He did what was evil in the eyes of Hashem, though not as much as the kings of Israel who preceded him. However, the fate of the northern tribes was already sealed. Due to their generations of sinfulness, only complete tshuva could have turned things around. At this late stage, partial improvement would not suffice. Abarbanel explains that the situation with Malchut Yisrael at this late stage in the game is like a person who seriously neglects his health for many years. Imagine someone who eats junk and fast food exclusively and has been told by his physician that his arteries are clogged. Even if at the end of his life, this person were to begin to eat healthy food and exercise, it wouldn't reverse the dangerous impact on his heart. His lifestyle has been a form of slow suicide. In a similar fashion, the Talmud in Tinus 30b relates that Hoshea ben Ela finally removed the sentries who had until this point guarded the road to the Beit HaMikdash, to Yerushalayim, so that people would not be Ola L'Regel, travel to the Beit HaMikdash for the festival. Removing the sentries at this point, however, is too little too late. The people have drifted too far to care about connecting to God, and they don't even take the opportunity that's now available to them to make the trip to the Beit HaMikdash. It's like adopting a healthy lifestyle after the damage to your body had already been irrevocably done. Verses 6 and 7 describe the siege and capture of Shomron, as well as Sancheriv's policy of population transfer as a means of destabilizing the defeated nation and crushing any political opposition. This resettlement policy ensured that the 10 tribes would be lost to history as a coherent Jewish unit. The next section of the parak focuses on the history and causes of the degeneration and exile of the 10 tribes. Verses Zion to Yud Zion, 7 to 17, detail all the different ways that the people of Malchut Yisrael abandoned Hashem and served Avodah Zarah. In Sefer Malachim, worship of idolatry is an ever-present challenge and temptation, a fundamental struggle for the Jewish people and the primary cause of their ultimate exile. When studying the Navi and absorbing these stories as a modern reader, idolatry is arguably the practice in the Torah that is least relatable to us today. I don't know about you, but when I visit the antiquities section of the Met in Manhattan, I don't feel an urge to bow down to the statues there. However, during most of the period of Tanakh, pagan worship posed an enormous temptation for people, drawing them away from service of God. The Gemara in Sanhedrin 102b relates that Rav Ashi, one of the Amoraim, the rabbis of the Gemara, had a dream where he asked King Menasheh, the most evil of the kings of Yehuda, why he, who was a brilliant Torah scholar, worshipped idols. Menasheh told him, "If you had lived during my time, you would have lifted the hem of your robe so that you could run faster to serve Avodah Zarah." Clearly, if Rav Ashi could not relate to this urge to worship idols, there must have been some sort of fundamental historical shift in the nature of human experience that precipitated this disparity of experience. What was that shift? What changed? And why? Rabbi Jeremy Kagan, in his fabulous book, The Choice to Be, explains that in the ancient world, man experienced selfhood and reality in a completely different manner than we experience it today. All ancient societies were worshiping societies. They worshiped because they experienced their self as centered in its transcendent source. Therefore, ancient peoples had a natural recognition of their dependence on their source, and they felt a need to attach themselves to it. This phenomenon was not an intellectual conclusion. Rather, it was an experience of reality that is completely different than our own. Today, although we may believe in God, we don't experience ourselves as rooted in God as our source of being. Since in ancient times, people experienced themselves as naturally connected to their source, to not worship was inconceivable. We'll discuss shortly why this experience is not something we can relate to today. Before we discuss what has changed, let's try to understand what the lore of Avodah Zarah was in ancient times. Why not just approach Hashem instead of idols to get prosperity and success? We will need to go back to the creation story to explain. When the world was created, vegetation remained beneath the soil until Adam, prayed for rain. Rain is a metaphor for God's abundance in filling all of our many human needs. However, the abundance only comes when Adam prays for it, when people recognize their reliance on God. Hashem is waiting to supply our needs, but we need to reach out and ask. To put it another way, Adam did not pray because he needed rain. He needed rain because he had to pray. The goal is not the rain. The goal is the relationship. When a person turns to Hashem and recognizes that he is dependent on Hashem to provide all his needs, he is forced to recognize that his needs and his challenges are growth opportunities sent to him so that he will create a relationship with Hashem. A servant of Hashem who wants to build that relationship seeks to nullify himself before Hashem. He thinks, "What does Hashem want from me?" In ancient times, when people tried to fill their needs through appealing to Avodah Zarah, they were trying to circumvent this system. Their focus was on the filling of their needs for comfort, success, pleasure, rather than fulfilling God's purpose in creation, which was for man to build a relationship with God. As the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah indicates, idolatry was transactional. The gods needed service, and man provided service in exchange for benefits. The idol worshiper thinks, "What can my gods do for me? How can I control and influence them to give me wealth, power, success?" It's a sophisticated form of self-indulgence and self-worship, a way of getting what I want without having to perfect my character or subjugate myself to God's will. Ultimately, the challenge of not worshiping Avodah Zarah, as evidenced by the eventual destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, proved too great a challenge for the Jewish people. The Talmud records a singular event in Jewish history in Yuma 69b, which is a request for the nullification of the Yetzer Hara, the desire to worship Avodah Zarah. Hashem accedes to this request, and the strong urge to worship Avodah Zarah was simply excised from the human psyche at that time. However, the only way to blunt the inclination to worship idols was to blunt the sense of dependence on our transcendent source. By extension, as Rabbi Kagan explains, we traded in an inclination to worship, whether we worshiped properly, directed to Hashem, or improperly with idolatry, for an inclination to not worship at all. This event, the removal of the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, signified a monumental shift in the way people experienced reality. The far-reaching historical and ontological implications of this profound shift are beyond the scope of this class. But suffice it to say that the slow transformation in world history and human experience from ancient God-centered worshiping societies to modern secular humanism has its roots in this fundamental spiritual shift in the human experience. Let's talk about how all this relates to us. On the one hand, we can't relate to idol worship because we live in a world that feels no need to worship, no need to move outside of the self. However, although we have no natural pull to nullify ourselves before a higher being, we are still tasked with developing a relationship with God. But since we live in a world that doesn't experience God as naturally connected to ourselves, we first need to find God in a world that hides him very well. The last section of the Perek addresses the influx of a new population, transferred by Sancheirev into the north of Israel, called the Kutim, or the Shomronim, the Samaritans. The Kutim form their own hybrid religion, integrating Judaism with pagan elements. This also leads to problems with Jewish intermarriage and assimilation with the Kutim, which extends even into the period of Bayit Sheni. Sefer Ezra explains that when the Jews return to the land of Israel to build the second Beit HaMikdash, it is the Kutim who use every means at their disposal to try to obstruct its rebuilding. We spent the bulk of our time today explaining why Avodah Zarah exerted such a pull over the Jewish people in ancient times. Avodah Zarah was a way of getting the things you wanted without having to invest in a relationship with God. We also explain that the removal of the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah completely changed the nature of human experience, with a God-focused experience of self being replaced by an experience of self that is focused inward, on the self, rather than on God. It's hard to see God in our world because we don't naturally experience ourselves as connected to him. However, the spiritual barrenness of our world is actually what defines our mission today. Our job is to find God in a world that blocks us from seeing him at every turn. For further insight into this challenge, I recommend the book I mentioned earlier, A Choice to Be, by Rabbi Jeremy Kagan. It is a deep and very insightful read. Thank you for studying together. L'iloi Nishmas Frida, Bat Moshe Eliyahu.